Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Jack Cushman. I'm a reporter with the New York Times, and I'm the Secretary of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club. And today I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience, as well as those of you who are listening to this program on National Public Radio or watching on C-SPAN. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On May 13th, Jesse Brown, Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, will discuss the Clinton administration's new perspectives on veterans issues. On May 17th, entertainer Victor Borga will reminisce about some of his finest hours. On May 25th, Hazel O'Leary, Secretary of the Department of Energy, will discuss the Clinton administration's energy agenda, including the BTU tax that you're hearing so much about. And on May 27th, Alejandro Junco, President of the Inter-American Press Association, will discuss abuses of press freedoms throughout Latin America. Audio tapes of National Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. Richard Riley was, in the view of many educators, a logical choice to become Secretary of Education in the Clinton administration. He's qualified as a friend of Bill Clinton, since both were Southern governors determined to push school reform bills through their states' legislatures. Mr. Riley fought for and won passage of an Education Improvement Act in South Carolina that is still considered one of the most comprehensive packages approved during the wave of school reform legislation that swept through the country during the 1980s. His coalition building with business leaders in that reform effort was considered particularly effective. He ultimately won a hard-fought campaign to increase the state's sales tax to help pay for the reforms. These included tougher high school graduation requirements and increased pay for teachers. Mr. Riley had acted quickly to comply with federal court orders to desegregate South Carolina's public colleges and universities. His own four children remained in public schools after many other white parents moved their children from public to private schools following federal school desegregation orders in the early 1970s. A native of South Carolina, Mr. Riley earned a bachelor's degree in political science from Furman University and a law degree from the University of South Carolina School of Law. He worked briefly in his family's law firm before entering state politics in 1963. He served as both a state representative and a state senator before being elected to the first of 2 4-year terms as governor in 1978. After leaving the governorship, he returned to the practice of law, and he also served as a fellow at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Since being confirmed as Secretary of Education in January, Mr. Riley has announced administration initiatives both in elementary, secondary, and in higher education. For example, although elementary secondary education historically has been largely controlled by state and local governments, the Clinton administration has proposed legislation that would set national standards, albeit voluntary ones, for student performance and for the content of school curricula and services. We'll be interested to know whether this former state governor now has become an advocate of an expanded federal control over education. In higher education, Mr. Riley won praise from many college and university leaders during his confirmation hearing when he expressed strong support for minority scholarships, thus signaling an end to the Bush administration's proposal to ban scholarships set aside for members of racial and ethnic minority groups. Recently, though, although the administration has won praise for its national service proposal, some college leaders have said they were stunned by the austerity of the administration's proposed budget for higher education for the next fiscal year. Proposed cuts in some programs have led college leaders to complain that the budget is too reminiscent of the Bush administration's education budgets. Meanwhile, the administration is fighting the banks and fighting Sallie Mae as it sets us about to revamp student loan programs. So, 5 months into the new administration, Mr. Riley faces increasing questions about the administration's overall goals for education. But he came to Washington with a reputation as being a low-key but dogged negotiator. Secretary of Education, Richard Riley.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you so much, Jack, and thank you all for giving me the chance to be here with you. It's a real honor and pleasure to speak with the National Press Club. I know a lot of other members of the administration have been here. I've heard and seen a couple of them. And someone told me coming in that since I was the education secretary, that instead of answering questions, I perhaps ought to give you all a test before I leave. And I want you to know that that's probably not going to happen, so you can relax. I am so interested in the relationship of the media to education, television and radio. We've had some interesting things happening here in Washington, some media exhibits at the Capitol yesterday, and a technology conference this week. I remember when I was governor of South Carolina and fighting for major education reform, one of the things that we tried to do was to stir up people throughout the state on the school level, the community level, family level. And Tucky, my wife, and I made speeches all over the state. I think they counted some 500 in all over a period of around a year. And I was down in a little small town of South Carolina in the rural part of the state. On one of these occasions, I'd go in, sit down in the back of the class. This was a little first grade class and had these little desks you have to get down into. And then I let the teacher teach for a minute and then get up and comment to the class about the importance of what the teacher was talking about. And this one finished. I got up. This press then from the nearby cities, of course, this was a big deal. The governor come into this little small town. They'd never had a governor even visit the town, not to mention this elementary school. So I was there and all the TV and radio, and I got up to comment on the teacher was teaching math, and I was telling him how I use that every day in the governor's office. And a little fella there, Kenneth, they had their names across the front of their desk like first graders do. And he had Kenneth across there, and he was jerking around and pulling the girl in front of him and pointing at the camera and the highway patrol out the window. And I said, you know, I'm going to kind of help this teacher understand discipline and all this press and all here and explain how to handle these children. I said, Kenneth, this loud voice, and he looked up. I said, Kenneth, my office is in Columbia. Have you ever been to Columbia? And he looked up, and the cameras came in on him, and the radio people stuck their mics in. Everybody got tuned in. He said, yeah, Governor. He said, my mother and daddy and I went to a football game 2 weeks ago, and daddy got drunk, and we had to bring him straight home. So I haven't done any teaching since, and I've been very reluctant to get too involved with the media after Kenneth's daddy watched the news that evening. I don't know how they stand. I was reminded today of another young man that I met. Jack mentioned my experience at Harvard to Kennedy School for a semester. And one of the features, as you know, there, these open forums, they're very wide open, free-flowing events. I was at a panel on education. Roger Porter was in the panel, Derek Bach, Pat Graham of the Education Department, and so forth. And it was a very interesting, stimulating discussion. After that, the students or whomever come up and ask questions. And I looked out, and a big fella came up to the microphone, said he wanted to ask me a question. I could look at him and tell two things. I knew he He weighed 250 pounds or so. I knew he was black. I could tell by his warm southern voice that he was southern. And he introduced himself as Jeff Livingston, and he proceeded to tell, introducing his question by telling about South Carolina's Education Reform Act and how he and his parents had worked for passage, even for the tax, and that how it had given him the chance as a student in high school and middle school there in my state to take advanced placement courses, to come out of a public high school and enter Harvard as a sophomore. He was very grateful in his question for this opportunity, and I will tell you I was very grateful for his statement. The fact is that this young person's story says a lot to me about what we can do in this country for education. Lyndon Johnson said mankind is in a race between education and chaos. And today a number of our schools and their neighborhoods have already plunged into chaos. And I think we all know the clock is ticking in many others. It's been 10 years and some 15 days since the landmark study, A Nation at Risk, reported that for the first time in the history of our country, it said, the educational skills of one generation will not surpass, not equal, not even approach those of their parents. Now that was a heavy statement, and it caught on. Over a decade later, we're still without a comprehensive national response to the problem. And for too many of our students, achievement levels remain shockingly low while other nations' students seem to move ahead. Now, if we don't face up to this challenge and meet it, I think we face what I have said around is an unacceptable future for many, many of our children, for many of our communities. I think we've got to reclaim our children's futures. I think we must have school reform and restructuring, comprehensive and sustained reform, I think is the key to improving schools and student performance. I think we've got to have higher standards in an international marketplace and an information century. Countries that meet world-class standards simply have the edge. I saw firsthand in South Carolina how high standards coupled with comprehensive school reform can really make a difference. And in 1982, for example, before our reforms were developed, only about 2,500 students were enrolled in advanced placement courses in our state. And as a result of reform, there's been almost 400% increase in the students taking these courses, students like Jeff Livingston. Let me give you another example. In 1983, just 42% of our eighth graders in South Carolina passed their basic skills math test, and only 56% passed their reading test. In 91, 73% passed their math test, and 75% passed their reading test. And this, to me, again, is convincing testimony to the power of comprehensive reform that everybody is involved with and in. President Clinton campaigned on a pledge to bring change to our nation's schools and to give every student a first-class education, not just to add money to a program, but change. The American people supported that goal, and now to achieve it, We must get every single segment of our society involved in this reform process. Now, I don't agree with those in this school reform movement who believe that reform is best driven from the top down, driven by national experts. I think we need to reach out to everyone who can help, and that includes certainly the media. Your participation is extremely and especially vital. I know that it's true from a personal experience because I have seen the effect that you can have. When I launched my fight for reform in South Carolina, the media's coverage on this issue was absolutely intensive. Special reports on the issue appeared weekly in newspapers and on television and radio. The stories highlighted the positive innovations and the improvements of reform in a very exciting, engaging way. And they alerted the public to the need for change and the hope for a better system of education, and kept the issue on the front burner and helped force the legislature to act. And now at the national level, I again invite your involvement to help. I'm determined to make the Department of Education media friendly, to open our department to you and through you to the American people. I think that's important to this country. And as part of that effort, I'm pleased to announce that I've appointed as my director of communication one of your own, Catherine Kaler, a chairwoman and former president of the National Press Club. Kay has already given me an education. She's taught me lots of things quickly. She's taught me that one thing that reporters and editors, writers like more than anything else is a people story. And I liked hearing that because people really are what education is all about anyhow. And people are at the heart of this administration's new plan for education. More a national partnership than a national program, this plan will bring together parents and grandparents, educators, community groups, business, labor leaders, social health professionals, citizens all to reinvent our nation's public school systems. And I'm talking, of course, about Goals 2000, the Educate America Act, and it's President Clinton's bold new plan to forge a new alliance for change among communities, states, and the federal government. Now, Goals 2000 will launch a new era. America will go from a nation at risk to what I have described as a nation on the move, one crisis-oriented and very important, serving an important purpose, the other a positive, progressive move forward. First, Goals 2000 will lead to the creation of new world-class learning standards. We're going to set the bar high, and our children will be expected to know as much or more than children in any other country. I'm not satisfied when our kids rank near the bottom on international tests, and I don't think the American people are either. Second, Goals 2000 will raise expectations for all students, not just some students. Children will no longer be allowed to perform poorly simply because they are expected to perform poorly. Third, Goals 2000 will enrich course content, improve teacher training, and provide the textbooks and the technologies necessary to help students meet the new higher standards. Fourth, Goals 2000 will challenge our schools to show real results. We will assess student progress carefully to ensure that they are learning, and they are learning what they are supposed to be learning. Finally, Goals 2000 will achieve these aims without mandating what states and local districts must do. We are fully sensitive and aware of the fundamental function and responsibility of the state and local government in this area, and that will be fully respected. Community and state participation in the program, as Jack pointed out, will be voluntary. The federal role will be to provide guidelines and resources to help communities and states strengthen their own efforts and to reform their own systems and to reach internationally competitive standards. Now, I've said a lot quickly so far, but it really comes down to this. We're going to make sure that our children know what they need to know and be able to do what they need to do to succeed in an increasingly competitive world. I say our children, I want to also include grandchildren for some of my older friends here and my wife. We had, Tunkey called me the other day, we had our sixth grandchild born in South Carolina, and so she went home to be with my daughter for a couple of weeks before the child was born. She called me up. She said, Dick, she said, I need some help. I said, what's that? She said, well, you're supposed to be the big person in education, right? I said, that's right. She said, well, I'm having trouble teaching Pierce. Pierce is 2 years old, kind of a little round boy, and he's just getting real devilish. And I said, well, what's the trouble? She said, well, I'm trying to teach him how to brush his teeth. And I said, well, he won't do it. She said, no, he'll brush his teeth, but he won't spit. And I said, well, now there, you do need some help. She said also he's into cooling his food and said he blows his food, but he blows it while it's in his mouth. I have so some things I can't help with, and I'll be perfectly honest up front. But at the heart of this Goals 2000 legislation are two very exciting and innovative undertakings. First, at the national level, a special panel will be formed to launch a truly historic effort to establish America's first voluntary national standards for what students should know, student performance, and the essentials of teaching and learning. These standards will be tough, and as I say, they will be world class. While this effort is proceeding, communities and states will be hard at work too. They'll be drawing up what we refer to as action plans that describe their own local efforts and raise standards. And each action plan will be a detailed blueprint that specifies how the state plans to raise their own students' performance, enrich their own curricula, strengthen teacher training and professional development, provide access to new technologies, make instructional materials available, and so on, their own plans. Each state will also describe how the state plans to assess progress. And the states can then ask the national panel to evaluate their standards, judge how closely they come to meeting the world-class standards, and offer suggestions. Under the bill, $393 million, the great proportion of the money, is earmarked to help communities implement their own implementation plans. Individual schools will get the lion's share of the money, and that's absolutely key because Goals 2000 is not about creating bureaucracies. It's about improving the quality of teaching and learning that goes on in our children's classroom. And just think of everything that this new program hopefully will accomplish. For the first time, schools and students will know exactly what world-class standards are, what they have to do to reach them, and how much progress they're making. For the first time, communities that want their kids to be the best in the world will have a partner in the federal government, an ally that provides guidance and resources. The program doesn't force a one-size-fits-all approach because improvement plans will very likely differ from school to school, district to district, region to region. Community groups, parents, even grandparents will be more involved than ever before. We will actively seek their input in setting standards, and we will ask for their help in providing tutoring, social help, and other services that encourage learning. And most important of all, school reform will happen where it must happen if it's to succeed, and that's on the local level with a national purpose. Let's also look at Goals 2000, and let me assure you that it does not ignore those students who will move right into the workforce from high school. The bill creates a National Workforce Standards Board to strengthen and improve the link between education and employment. The board will identify essential occupational and workforce skills and create a system of standards, assessments, and certification in this area too. And by developing both world-class academic and occupational standards, Goal 2000 will help create a high-skill, high-wage workforce that will someday be the best in the world. Goal 2000, Educate America Act, isn't a silver bullet that will... Good. You're welcome. Thank you. That woke you all up, anyhow. This plan, Goals 2000, is not a silver bullet that will solve all problems, and it's not supposed to be. Teaching and learning is hard. Teaching and learning is not easy, one-directional thing that you can solve easily. Every child is different. Every teacher is different. Every community is different. But it is a critical first step that can enlist grassroots America in this fight for reform. To reach out to people and to communities, we will join the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to conduct national satellite town meetings every month. These interactive TV conferences that we've had for several months now will enable us to share information and exchange ideas with citizens in thousands of towns across America. We've even set up an 800 number so people can call us directly to get involved. Dial 1-800-USA-LEARN. Jack and I both sound like Ross Perot up here giving you numbers to call. Once there was a popular book, you all recall it perhaps, Why Johnny Can't Read, which pointed out all the features and the failures that we knew were there of American education. It was published in the 50s when I imagine a lot of you were around in grade school. I bring it up to remind you that America has had an educational crisis all along when you were children, and the nation met the challenge. We have another crisis in the lives of our children. I'm confident that with the right leadership, everyone working together, that we can meet the challenge once again. Some say the plan is controversial. I ask you, is it? We led the world to the moon. We led the free world in the Cold War. We led the whole world in Operation Desert Storm. And I wonder, is there any reason that we can't lead the world in math and science? The three guiding principles of Goal 2000, teaching and learning, higher standards for all children, and commitment to partnership, are at the core of what President Clinton has called a new ethic of learning. and millions of struggling Americans are yearning for this new ethic. For many of them, education offers the only hope for a brighter future. For too long, we've allowed that hope to die. And now it's time, I think, to restore it. It's time, as the President says, to rekindle the dream that good schools offer. Thank you very much.